Feel better already. Is everybody out there still happy, joyous, and free?
Yeah.
All right. I feel like a cheerleader up here. I am really, really excited to introduce the next speaker. I really, really love hearing him share. I am really impressed, and I am really excited to have met him. Would everybody give a warm welcome to Mr. Johnny H. from Lakewood, California.
Hi, everybody. My name's Johnny, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Johnny.
And I'm very glad to be here tonight. Sober. And I think I'd like to clarify that word sober for you before I go any further. When I talk about being sober, I don't think nothing about putting anything of a chemical solution in my system. When I think about being sober, I think about the way I live. The way I live today is not conducive for getting loaded. Now, the reason I tell you that is this. For 27 years of my life, I lived a certain way. And I could not keep from getting loaded. Now, for almost 23 years of my life, I've lived an entirely different way, and it hadn't been necessary for me to put anything chemically in my system for almost 23 years. So I don't think about taking anything when I think about sober. I think about the way I live. I was awfully pleased to be here tonight fully clothed and in my right mind. And I know that don't do a lot for you. But you ought to be up here with me. You see, the reason I say that is because the longer I stay sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, the more necessary it becomes for me to remember from whence I came. And I don't ever want to forget that a little over 24 years ago right now, I was crawling around on my knees in a cell in solitary confinement in a maximum security penitentiary. And because of a loving God, as He expressed Himself through a program called Alcoholics Anonymous, it's no longer necessary for me to crawl around on my hands and knees like an animal. Now, if I don't get nothing out of this deal at all, I can live with that all the way home. Kind of warms me a little. I would love to be able to stand here tonight or at a podium of Alcoholics Anonymous or anywhere else in the world and be able to say to you, that's where alcohol and drugs took me to. I'd love to be able to tell you that. That's where I took me to. The only thing that alcohol and drugs did in my life, they kept me alive long enough to find you. I'm just as sure as I'm standing here without alcohol working in my life, I'd have blown my brains out before I was 9 years old. Because as far back as I could ever possibly remember, I've been an emotional left fielder. I have. I've always been out there somewhere. I used to wander around out there someplace. I felt different, and I didn't belong anywhere. I wandered around in a world I didn't like, around people that I didn't want to do anything with. And I didn't understand what was going on because I had a hole inside of me I didn't understand. And I was encompassed in a completely and total world of absolute anger. I hated everything that moved. And I didn't understand it. That was my earliest recollection in life of how angry I was. I used to wander around and look at them. And they knew something that I didn't know, those people. They had something that I didn't have, those people. You know who they are? They're the reason we're in here. And if you don't know who they are, you belong in Al-Anon. They're still out there. And I didn't understand that. I run around most of my life, well, my entire life, up into and including coming into Alcoholics Anonymous. I run around in the world trying to figure out who was responsible for the way I felt. Because it wasn't my fault. It was their fault. And the first set I had a good excuse. from inception, I had a good excuse. I had a drunken mother, a drunken father, four drunken uncles, three drunken aunts, and a drunken grandfather. And I said to myself, well, no wonder I feel different. I've been born beneath my station. These are the bad people. And I don't belong around them, so I got to go out and find out where I belong, and that's what I did. I remember my first excursion into the world to try to find out where I was going to belong. I looked up one day, and I found a kindly old lady standing in front of me who was my grandmother. Now, my grandmother was a great old gal. She was almost 90 years old, and she never took a drink or smoked a cigarette in her life. My grandmother prayed a great deal, and she wasn't like these other folks. And I had some kind of an idea in my head that all I would have to do is go where my grandmother went, and I wouldn't feel the way I felt. See, I never wanted to feel the way I felt. I never wanted to be angry. I never wanted to hate everybody. I never wanted to feel different and apart and strange and weird. I never wanted to feel those ways. And I just had some kind of an idea if I could just show up where Grandma went, I could find my folks, I could sit down and be wonderful. That's what I wanted to do. And so Sunday one time, my grandmother said, today you get to go with me, Johnny. And I said, where? She said, I'm going to church. I remember how excited I was because I was just going to sit down there and be fine now. I left these people that I felt different and strange and irritable and hated. And I went over and sat down in this church around these good people, and I felt different and strange and irritable and hated all them too. I didn't understand it. And then I did something that I did most of my life up into and including coming into Alcoholics Anonymous. I sat in that church a long, long time ago while this man in those long flowing robes, one of them quote and unquote superior people, mounted that rostrum. And I remember sitting in that church at my grandmother's knee. Different, strange, irritable, full of hatred, with a hole in my gut I didn't understand. And I'm waiting for this man of authority to tell me why I feel that way. And even more important than that, I want him to tell me what to do about it. And you know what he said? He said, I was supposed to love and honor and respect my parents. He said, I was supposed to love my brothers. And I didn't. I hated them. I hated them for a reason I didn't even understand. I felt very guilty about that. I became frightened to death sitting in the church. They were going to find out I was hating when I was supposed to be loving. I didn't know what to do about that. Turned to walk outside the door of the church that day. My old man standing there drunk and hungover. He reached over and tapped me on the head and said, son, if you continue to go to church, you're going to grow up to be just like me. There's a lot of things in life I didn't want to be, but my old man wasn't one of them. Because he was a drunk, and I hated him for it. And I hated my mother because she was a drunk. And I lived in a house where there were two drunks working. If you haven't lived in a nightmare like that, I'm going to explain it to you. In a house like that, in the middle of the night, they're screaming and yelling and cussing and flesh hitting flesh and breaking furniture and deathly silence. Every once in a while, the old man come and got me and kicked me around. Now, he never did it to my brothers. He just did it to me. I can remember laying there in the middle of the night wondering what's going on. I don't understand any of those things. Frightened, scared to death he's out there somewhere. He's going to come and get me. And I'm laying there in terror. I'm thinking about that stuff. Thinking about my uncles who are in the penitentiaries. I think about my aunts who live in those houses on the other side of the tracks. I think about my grandfather who burns down barns. I think about my mother who beats up my old man, and my old man who beats up my mother. And I'm trying to figure out what causes all those things. And somewhere way back there in the middle of the night, it dawned on me what the problem was. It's alcohol. That's the problem. They drink. They do those things. I'm not going to drink because I'm not going to be like them. I'm going to be better than they are. I'm going to step out in that world. I'm going to have something, and I'm going to do something, and I'm going to be something. But what do you do if you're weird? I'll tell you what I did. I took a drink. Taking a drink to a person like me is not a thing to applaud at, folks. And I'll tell you what happened to me. That thing went down inside of me and just kind of tore that madness from me. That's what alcohol did for me. Alcohol took me from the black pit of nothingness and it stood me into the gray fringes of the business of living and installed in me some type of arrogance and said, damn you, world, it's all right. Maybe I'm not good enough to be around the good people and maybe I'm too good to be around the bad people, but it's okay right here. That's what alcohol did for me. Now, I'm going to tell you a strange secret. If alcohol still did that, I'd still drink it. And the reason I don't drink alcohol or put chemicals in my system anymore is because they don't do that. And if you're alcoholic like I'm alcoholic and they're still working in your life, sooner or later you're going to work them again. Then my experience with the disease of alcoholism that you don't ever quit doing anything you can still do. That's the truth. And I don't know why that is. I'd like to tell you that during the next 20 years of my life, I did something fantastically exciting while I drank. Every time I got drunk, I did the same thing. I took a drink. 3 days later, they pulled me out from underneath a bridge and stood me in front of a judge and sentenced me to the Hutchinson State Reform School. 20 years later, I took a drink of alcohol. They pulled me out of a car in Compton and stood me in front of a judge and sentenced me to 20 years in the penitentiary. Every time I drank, that's what happened to me. I got drunk and went places. And the places of which I went had fences around them. And it never varied. Now, I can stand here right now and tell you almost 23 years come a week from tomorrow. I haven't had a drink or a sedating pill or a smoke of grass or haven't stuck any needles in my arm. And I'd like to stand here and tell you right now that I quit doing all that. I haven't quit drinking. I haven't quit taking pills. I haven't quit smoking grass, and I haven't quit sticking needles in my arm. They quit me. They just quit me. I don't know nothing about quitting. I do not know how to quit drinking. I had a guy ask me that the other night. Had a meeting, he said, I can't quit drinking. What do you think I ought to do? And I said, I think you ought to go hit a policeman in the mouth. He said, why? And I said, that'll get you quit for a little while. My mother took me out of that reform school and brought me to California. We said, we get to California, things are going to be different. They were. We left our one-room shack in Kansas and came to California and got us a one-room shack with a bathroom. My mother got me a couple of new uncles and introduced them to me. And I went out on the street corner and got drunk. And I made a fantastic discovery. I found out that alcohol would do the same thing to me in California that it did in Kansas. And in my way of thinking, it was the only thing I'd ever found in my life that ever did the same thing twice in succession. I was tired of people telling me things they weren't going to do. I was tired of getting my hopes and dreams and aspirations that high off the ground, having kicked the stool out from underneath me. But I found out if I threw a brick through a window and got a bottle of Marco Petri red wine and drank it, it did exactly what I anticipated doing. It went down in there and just kind of tore the madness from me. It took me from over there and it stood me there and it gave me that. And I got drunk and went to juvenile hall. And I spent the next 3.5 years of my life in a running court battle with my mother, a lawyer, and a judge. Once a month it went like this. Once a month my mother come to visit me and she said, I love you and I miss you. And when you come home, things are going to be different. Once a month we went in front of a judge. He sends me to Whittier State Reform School. Once a month my mother stood up with a lawyer and appealed it. Now, for a long, long time, I didn't believe my mother when she came and told me she's going to be different because I'm not going to get kicked around anymore. I'm not going to get to believe in them people anymore. I'm going to be over there all by myself. I'm not going to get hurt anymore. I'm tired of getting hurt. They're hurting me. Somewhere during that 3.5-year period of my life, I switched over and started to believe my mother. And the reason I started to believe my mother is because I wanted so desperately to believe that the answer to my problem was in a little white house with a picket fence with an old lady in a crispy apron with a tray full of cookies and milk. I wanted so desperately to believe that the answer to my problem was over there in that. And there's a very good reason why I thought that way. You see, if that's the answer to my problem, I can live any way I want to live for as long as I want to live with anybody I want to live, do anything I want to do to any number of people I want to do to it for as long as I want to do it, and show up there at the little house and be wonderful. I'd never have to change. I could just rip and run and roar and take and end up over here and be wonderful. At the end of that 3.5 years, they put me in a boys' home in San Fernando Valley. When I got there, the superintendent said, if you're a good kid, we're going to let you go home on a home trip in 30 days. And God, I was good. 30 days came and went, and they loaded us on an old truck, and they brought us out of the valley, and it was an all-day trip. They dropped us off in downtown Hollywood. I had to run to catch the old subway car and ride down to town of L.A., and I had to run to catch the old red car to ride out to Willowbrook where I lived. And I got off the ground running 1.5 miles to my mother's house. I can remember it like it was yesterday. Around the corner and down the street, it's all over now. No more difference than, no more parts from. It's going to be fine. I got to my mother's house. There was a drunken party going on there. Nothing had changed except me. I'd spent 3.5 years in juvenile hall. I'd heard a lot of strange things. I'd heard things like everybody's a liar and everybody's a cheat. Never believe anybody that used to tell me because that's a sign of weakness. Never show anybody that you care for them, they used to tell me, because that's weakness. And more important than anything else, never reach your hand up out of the gutter, because the minute you do that, they come along and kick you in the teeth. I don't want to believe that, because there was something down here that says it's not true. Walked out of my mother's house that day and made a vow to myself I lived to be 500 years old. I'd never show anybody any human emotions again. I went out on the street corner and got drunk. I come home next month and got drunk again. Long about that time in my life, I was a periodic. Well, I was forced to be a periodic. They only let me out once a month, so I only got drunk once a month. It was always the same thing. I'd come home, throw a brick through a window, get a bottle of Marco Petri red wine, and get drunk and go back to school. My first week in school was fine. I was a scholar. I read inspirational books. My second week in school was fine. I was an athlete. I took strenuous exercise. My third week in school, the madness set in because I started to think. I started to think about showing up in the neighborhood. I start to think about walking up to my gang. My gang wanted me to be their leader. I don't want to be their leader. I keep saying to myself, I wonder what the gang would say if I was to tell them I didn't want to be a gangster. I want to be a doctor, lawyer, architect, or an engineer. I wonder what they would say. I wonder what my gang would say if I was to tell them I didn't want to go out and hit people in the head. I wanted to go play baseball. I wonder what they would say. But you see, if you're like me and you're nothing, and you're glued over there against the corner of the wall, you're trying to figure out what is that magic thing that frees you from there and stands you there and gives you that, you think about that. And finally the answer comes, it's a bottle of Marco Petri red wine. And you think about that for a while, about turning the cap on that baby and pouring it down and let that magic get all over you. One day I sit on the street corner with a gallon of that wine. I turned his cap on that baby and poured it down, drank the whole gallon. I'm sober as I am right now. Frightened to death. My magic wasn't magic anymore. I didn't know what to do about that. The guy come along and tapped me on the shoulder and said, why don't you try these? And he gave me some pills. I found out if I ate pills and drank wine, I could make the madness go away for a little while. Wasn't very much longer after that, on the same street corner with a sack of pills and a gallon of wine, nothing was working. The guy come along and tapped me on the shoulder and said, try this. And he gave me some morphine. I found out if I put morphine in my arms and swallowed pills and drank wine, that I had a combination of things that sustained me for the next 14 years of my life. Never one, never two, it was a combination of all of them. I became too old to stay in that school. I came out of my neighborhood to become a gangster. That was my ambition in life. I wanted to be the Irish Lucky Luciano of Willowbrook. But I had a problem I didn't stand up too often. That's not conducive for being a gangster. You don't walk in here and say, stick them up and puke on somebody. They really don't have a ring of machoism about it. I mean, you don't gather up in my neighborhood and talk about puking. You gather up in my neighborhood and talk about being tough. And the reason you gather up and talk about being tough is because you're scared to death. Somebody's going to find out you're scared to death. And you got to masquerade that fear with a lot of funny things like violence and hostility and arrogance and bad. See, I don't know how you were, but I can tell you about how I was. I never belonged anywhere. No matter where I was always less than. And when you're always less than, you got to do 17 times more than anybody else just to almost fit. And in my neighborhood, I had to be twice as bad. I had to use 4 times as much dope. I had to drink 6 times as much wine. I had to hit 5 many people in the head. I had to steal more. I had to do it just so they would almost let me enter into the conversation. And I tell you the sad part about that, I never wanted to do any of the things I ever did. Ever. But I had no control over what I was doing. I was powerless to do anything about it because I didn't know what else to do. It was my way of life. It was the life of the street people. I accepted it my way of life, and I also accepted all the consequences that went with this way of life, no matter what they were. The beatings, the jails, the nut houses, whatever it took to live in that life, that was my life. I accepted it because I was willing to pay any price, do anything and pay any price for the ability just to feel all right just for a little while. My sole motivation in life was get the money or get loaded, period. And heaven help you or anybody else that got between me and those two thoughts. And when you live that way and you think that way, you go to jail a lot. Because you're out there. And they just come along and say, get in. And you get in. And they say, where were you last night? And say, I don't know. Did you do this? I guess so. Okay, away you go. And that's the way I lived. It's the way it was. And the way it'll always be. And where it finally really came down in the late 40s and early 50s, I had some kind of an idea in my head. The lack of power was my dilemma. But I thought power came in a money clip. I thought if you had enough power, they couldn't bother you. So I got to accumulating some power. I got it all. I got a big apartment building. I moved into the top floor. I got me a closet full of $300 suits. I got a big automobile. I parked it in the garage. I got people coming around at all hours of the night and day begging the big man for favors. And every once in a while, the big man would grant them a favor. But you see, I couldn't leave the apartment because every time I did, they jumped on me and took me to jail. Every once in a while, I used to get brave. And I'd sneak out of there about 5 o'clock in the afternoon in one of my new suits and get in my big car, just me and my big car and my new suit. And I got nobody around to impress about what a big man I am, and I'm not too impressed with me anyhow. And I'm out there running around with people who are coming home from work, and I'm asking myself little funny questions like, what's the matter with me? Why can't I be like my brother? Why can't I just have a wife and a couple of kids and a job like everybody else? What's the matter with me? Jesus Christ, what's the matter with me? I didn't know. I thought God had picked me out for his own personal whipping post. 1951, I went to the penitentiary. I was on my way to the penitentiary for the first time, and my mother come to visit me in the old Los Angeles County Jail. And she screamed at me through the vision screen that I was a murderer. It seemed to my 17-year-old brother had gotten into some of my poison and taken an overdose of it and died. I didn't know how to handle that very well, but I handled like I handled most things. I got mad at it. Made it go away for a little while. 3 days later, they had me handcuffed between two detectives standing out underneath a tree while they bury my baby brother. Now, I got all the guilt and shame and humiliation and degradation of a lifetime hanging around my shoulders, and I'm trying to cry, and I don't know how. I don't have the simple gift of tears that God gives every creature that's born on the face of this earth, and the reason I don't have it because I don't think they're necessary. I went on to the penitentiary, and I stayed there 4.5 years. I came out of there 4.5 years sicker than I was when I went in there. I spent the next couple of years of my life trying to prove what a psychiatrist in San Quentin told me wasn't true. He said, Johnny, people like you don't change. He says, you're doomed to die in an institution. He took me down and showed me a little green room. Says, you're going to end up here, hotshot. And I told him, not me. I'm different. How come I walked out of that institution, bound determined, I had that deal beat, and 6 months later, I'm laying in a nut house, kicking and screaming. And that's when I made my round to some of the better laughing academies in the world, interviewing psychiatrists. That's what I used to do when I had nothing better to do. I'd talk to doctors. I sit there with my wraparound overcoat on. And we engage in great conversations. They talk to me about my mother, and I talk to them about their mother, and they threw me out of the room. And then they took me out and wired me for sound. That'll get your attention. I can tell you about those electroshock treatments, boy. I'll tell you, right now, today, I don't plug nothing in. Nothing. I have a very healthy appreciation of electricity. I remember the last time the skull jockeys worked me over. I was in this nut factory in Fort Worth, Texas, and they just gave me the better living through electricity treatment. And I remember how they always used to reduce me to a state of childishness one more time. And I remember this very vividly because it was my last trip out, or my next to my last trip out. It was a very bitter end for me emotionally, because I'm sitting across the table from this doctor, and I'm looking up on the wall behind his desk, and he's got a whole wall full of plaques that said where he's been, how many times he'd been there, who he'd done it to, why I was there, and everything. I mean, it was really impressive. And he just knew, when you look up there, they knew everything. And I'm sitting there. I got a hole in my gut that I had at my grandmother's knee. I feel exactly the same way sitting across the table from that doctor that I felt at my grandmother's knee 20 years prior to that. Only now I've got one problem more that's worse than all the other problems put together. Now, the things I used to put in me to make those problems go away no longer made them go away. Now, as long as I'm awake, I'm in trouble. Now I can't turn off the nightmares. Now I can't make the nameless faces of the people I'd harmed go away from me no more. Now, as long as I'm awake, I'm in trouble, and I don't know what to do. And I'm sitting there looking at, you know what the doctor said to me that day? Johnny, if you didn't drink these things and swallow these things and smoke these things and shoot these things, you wouldn't have any problems. You know, as sick as I was, I knew that wasn't the problem. My problem was I was nothing. I've always been nothing. I came from nothing. I was nothing. I was going to be nothing. I used to put something in me. I became almost to a nothing. Almost is top of the world. And here's a guy who's supposed to know telling me a nothing, that the thing I put in me to change me from a nothing to an almost is a problem, when I know the problem is I'm a nothing. That's like trying to tell the guy when the building fell down the elevator was defective. And I knew he didn't know. You know what 20 years of treatment in the state of California and the federal government got for me? They treated me, those people. They damn near killed me. You know what they proved to me without a shadow of a doubt? That there was nobody else upon the face of the earth like me at all. That I was unique unto myself. I'd been dropped off from another planet by a spaceship that somewhere, and they were never going to go back. And the reason they proved to me without a shadow, because they never did talk to me about the thing that I knew that was killing me. They always talked to me about the thing that made it bearable for me to live in a world I didn't belong to. And I came back to town to die, and almost 25 years ago now, they laid me bound in bed in the old Los Angeles County Jail. I weighed 128 pounds, and I was yellow, and they tied my left arm and my right leg down, and the medical doctor took the foot of my bed and told me he was going to die before morning. I said, okay. All day passed, and all night passed. He came back in my room the next morning. He stood at the foot of my bed and said, son, you're going to die, and there's nothing I can do for you. And I said, okay. All day passed, and all night passed. He came back in my room the next morning. He stood at the foot of my bed. I had a terror grip me that I've never known before or since in my entire lifetime. The idea came to me that I was going to live and not die. I was going to get up out of that bed and go to the penitentiary and come back out and start that rat race all over again, and God knows I didn't want to do that. I laid in that bed for 18 days and 18 nights. I didn't eat, sleep, drink, or do anything. I just laid there. And one night, because I knew nothing better to do, I screamed out the only prayer I'd ever said in my life. I said, oh, God, help me. Now, I thought for a long, long time nothing happened, because there was no blinding flashes of light. Nobody come running down the hall with a dozen donuts, and we got an A meeting down there. Little bird didn't come in and drop the fifth chapter on my chest. I didn't wander off into the sweet by and by. The only thing that happened to me is I went to sleep for a little while. And I don't know how many of you ever kicked a two-year heroin habit, but that's what I was doing. And that's the first time I'd been asleep in a long time. And I started to get better and better and better. And next thing I knew, I'm up running around the jail looking for some more of the stuff that just put me off the bed and just gotten off of. Now, I don't know what you call that, I call that absolute insanity. The alcoholic's inability to see himself as he really is the thing that kills us all. That's the alcoholic's world. So I don't know about normal people's world. I've never lived in it. My world is insanity. You know what my normal state is while sober? Insane. That's the alcoholic's normal state while sober, insanity. It is normal for alcoholics to be sitting in this room safe and sane and sober. Normal for all of us to either be drunk or sick and or insane. That's normal for the alcoholic. So why ain't I drunk right now? Why ain't I nuts right now? And I'll tell you why. Because I found the thing I looked at for in the end of a needle. I found the thing that I looked for in the bottle of that Marco Petri red wine bottle. I found the thing that I thought those pills and that grass and that heroin would put in me. That I knew never was. I'd found that thing. And I didn't find it right away. I didn't even know I was looking for it. Shortly after that, I'm standing in front of a Superior Court judge being sentenced to 20 years in the penitentiary. It means nothing to me at all. I turned to walk outside the courtroom that day, changed his conversation from me to a lady sitting in the courtroom, and what he said to her was the most damning piece of evidence anybody had ever presented about me in my life. He said to her, "Lady, if you care anything at all about the child you carry inside of you, you'll get so far away from this scum, he'll never be allowed to lay eyes on it. He's a blood-sucking parasite in society. He has no right being around decent people. If it's in my power, he's never going to be." And I'm walking out of the courtroom saying, "He's not talking about me. That must be my old man or my uncle's or my grandfather." But he was talking about me. And I knew he was talking about me. He put into words what I'd spent a lifetime trying to hide from the world. What I really, really was in here. Not what I put up out there, but what I was in here. That's the thing I kept trying to hide from the world. What I was in here. That's why I used to put that stuff in me. To make this stay down there. See? I went into the penitentiary with that knowledge, and I stayed in solitary confinement for the next 9 months of my life, because I tell you how self-obsessed I was. I thought the whole world was in that courtroom. And everybody knew about me now. And that's the way I was when I stumbled into my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous 23 years ago, a week from tomorrow. Now, I don't take any credit for coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, because if I'd have known Rob was coming 23 years ago, I wouldn't even come. The reason I came to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous is because the institution I was in allowed women to come in there. I came to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous almost 23 years ago to smell perfume. And I've been honking and sniffing around her ever since. You really have to be careful what gets us sick people in here. I remember my first impression of Alcoholics Anonymous. I moved down and sit into the back row in what I lovingly like to call my throne of contempt. I had my coat collar up and my shades on because I was cool. If I'd have been any cooler when I come here, I'd have froze to death, for God's sake. I remember looking up on the backboard. I saw two big A's, and I thought to myself, "My God, I've wandered into an anti-aircraft brigade." I didn't know what Alcoholics Anonymous was. And I said to this clown sitting next to me, "What is this?" He says, "It's Alcoholics Anonymous." I sunk down in my seat. Gangsters weren't supposed to be hanging out with them winos. If it had been Gangsters Anonymous or Overhip Anonymous or Dope Fiends Anonymous or something that had a little ring of class about it, I didn't want to be an alcoholic. I didn't know what one was. The word alcohol I was prejudiced against reminded me of my old man. Didn't stop me from drinking it, just reminded me of him a great deal. I thought, well, I'll wait for these women to get up and tell their racy stories, because I knew about women drunks. Boy, did I know about women drunks. And they got up and they threw me a curve. Because they had sort of a twinkle in their eye and a smile on their face, and they sort of raged at something I didn't understand. Right away they run it, they start to talk about God. And when I came here and you talked to me about God, I left. Because God was the reason I was. It was not my fault. I kept coming back to your meetings because I'd seen you. And seeing you, I had seen the miracle, and I didn't know that either. I come back to the meetings, you talk about God, I left. I wandered around the institution thinking about you. Them funny people with the dancing eyes and the smiling faces and that air of peace about them. Only I didn't even know it was an air of peace. I didn't know what peace was. Every once in a while, I'd grab one of them convicts and throw him up against the wall and look in his eyes and say, you don't have it, and turn around and walk off. You get a lot of strange comments in those places when you start doing stuff like that. Now, a long time ago now, I don't know where it was or when it was or what day it was or what month it was or nothing. I don't really know because it's really necessary for me to know. It was the day I lived my entire lifetime for. It's the day that every rotten, filthy, corruptible thing I'd ever done in my life had driven me right up to the very gates of hell. See, I didn't even know I was in hell. I had no way of knowing when I woke up that morning and got up and went about my business that I was going to be sitting in a room and somebody was going to put the key into the gates of hell and let me out of there. I didn't know that. And if I'd have been armed with that knowledge when I woke up that morning, I'd have never went to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. I'd have went over and talked to them, to the doctors or to the warden or to the preachers or to the teachers or to the counselors or somebody. I wasn't conditioned to go to drunks for answers. I was conditioned to go to them, and they didn't know. I tell you how sick I was willing to go anyhow. That's how sick I was. Not armed with that knowledge. I wonder how they're doing out there in the half measures room. Hold on for a little while, folks. We'll have a dance. You can come in then. That's the way it is, folks. Some folks come for some things, and some folks come for other things. And I'm glad enough of you come for sobriety. And not the music and the fast lights and the soft bodies. And that's the way it is. That's the way it is where I live. And that's the way it is where you live. And that's the way it is we all live. And don't ever let anybody else tell you any different. I went to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting a long, long time ago. A little guy stood at a podium that I knew did 23 flat years in the penitentiary, and he told me something I've never forgotten. It makes more sense to me than anything that I know. It'll make more sense to me tomorrow than anything I'll ever learn. He says, you don't have to live this way no more if you don't want to. He says, you just don't have to do it like this no more. Nobody had ever told me that. After the meeting, I ran up to him. I said, how do you learn how to live? And he gave me a book called Alcoholics Anonymous. He says, if you go home and read this book, I'll go home and pray that you find some part of you in it. Now, I guess he's prayed real hard, that little fella, because I've been a student of the book Alcoholics Anonymous from that day to this day. And the only thing I've ever found in that book is me. I haven't looked for anything else. I'm not looking for a way to sober up the world or cure all society's ills. I'm looking for a way to live peacefully and comfortably and joyously with me and the loving God that made me. Now, I'm going to tell you about the strange phenomena that takes place in my life. It seemed like to me that the closer I adhere to the principles that are written in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, and the more willing I become to share that knowledge in this fellowship, just for the sheer joy of doing it, the more peaceful and the more comfortable and the more joyous I live with me and the loving God that made me. Now, I had a lot of trouble with Alcoholics Anonymous when I came here because I wasn't like you people. There weren't anybody like me when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. There just wasn't. I was different. And when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and I was different, I only recognized differences. And the reason I only recognized differences, if you can only identify with differences, you never have to change. You can just stay different forever. They have to change. Not me. And when I was different in Alcoholics Anonymous, I used to hear things that I didn't understand. I'd hear people say, I used to drink. Now, I don't drink anymore, and everything is wonderful. I'd say, I guess I'm not alcoholic then. When I don't drink, all hell breaks loose. I didn't understand that. Then they used to tell me things like, you got to get active. And I didn't know what active was. And I remember one time I heard this phrase so much, and I'm reading that book, it didn't make any sense to me, and I heard a guy say, you got to get active. And a couple of days later, when there was nobody around the A&A secretary, I wandered over to him, and when nobody saw me talking to him, I asked him. I didn't want anybody to see me talking to the AA secretary. I had a reputation I was trying to preserve. I didn't want anybody to see me getting well. I didn't mind them seeing me being sick, but I didn't want them seeing me get well. And I wandered up to him and I said, I'd like to ask you a question. He said, what do you want to know? I said, I hear they got to get active in AA. He said, that's right. I said, I'd like to know what I can do so nobody know I'm a member. He said, what? I said, I want to know what I can do so nobody know I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He says, you're sick, aren't you? And I said, no. I was serious. I was dead serious. It took me a long time. You know what I was trying to do? You see, I wanted very desperately what you had. I wanted to be sober. And I wanted to have that good life. But I still wanted my lifestyle. See, I still wanted to be hip, slick, keen, and cool. I still wanted to be a gamer and a taker and a user of people. I wanted to take it and get it and be sober, too. See? Can't do that. Just couldn't do it. You can't live in two worlds. You just can't do that. You cannot live an honest program dishonestly. I mean, that's heavy, folks. It really is. You know what the program Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me? It's de-hipped me. It just... One of the problems, the biggest problem I had coming into Alcoholics Anonymous prior to working the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was an alcoholic. I thought, well, I play a silly game. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was a convict. And then I became a convict and a dope fiend. And how's that for real bad stuff? Huh? Is that good for being different? Oh, it gets better. I was a convict and a dope fiend and an alcoholic. Then I became a convict and a dope fiend and an alcoholic and a weirdo. And I just kept adding them anders in there. You know what anders are? Anders are doorways that allow you to leave Alcoholics Anonymous. That's all. Well, you may have to work them steps, but you're alcoholic. I'm an alcoholic ander. I don't have to do nothing but not drink. You know what I am today after 23 years? I'm an alcoholic. That means to me, if I'm alcoholic and you're alcoholic and you have to do something to stay sober, so do I. But by the same token, if I'm alcoholic and you're alcoholic and I have to do something to stay sober, so do you. I mean, there ain't no cafeteria here. I mean, you all eat the same meal, or we all die alone. That's as simple as I know how to put it, folks. And the reason I know that, what I am, not what you are, but what I am, because there was 100 people who wrote a book called Alcoholics Anonymous a few years ago, and they were all alcoholics. And they all did certain things. And as a result of doing certain things, they felt a certain way. And as a result of feeling a certain way, they tried to carry that message to alcoholics who still suffered. As a result of feeling a certain way. They wrote fantastic things in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, like, you cannot transmit something you ain't got. That means if I'm trying to carry the message of 12 steps of recovery, that doesn't mean that I can do that by taking one step. See? I'm an alcoholic, and then run off into the tulips. That's action in ignorance. Now, I may be completely out of whack, but I think what they were talking about when they say, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we try to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. So that means in everything that I do. That don't mean here and tomorrow I do anything I want to. See? That don't mean that at all. Not to me. There's been some strange things that's happened to me since I tried to fulfill the conditions of recovery in a program called Alcoholics Anonymous. And the first one were some non-alcoholic people got a hold of me. These were professional people who come into that penitentiary, and one of them was a dentist. Long about that time in my life, my vocabulary consisted of four-letter words. Mother ran all around in there somewhere. It was kind of like the trigger that made it all go. And I'm sitting there cutting this little dentist's hair one day, cussing him, and he said to me, if you ever get out, he said, the minute you open your mouth, they're going to know where you come from. I said, what's the matter with my mouth? He says, nothing, you just open it every now and then. And then he made a statement to me that nobody had ever possibly made to me before. He asked me if I knew what cussing was. And I said, no, what is it? He said, it's a crutch for conversational cripples. And I heard me say something I'd never heard me say before. I said, oh. What am I supposed to do about it? I've always talked this way. I know no other way to talk. And he said to me, if you're serious, I'll help you. And so a period of time, this little dentist and three of your little friends from town set me in a room, and they word by word, sentence by sentence, paragraph by paragraph, fed me the English language. I know today that those guys love me with a love that I very seldom have ever experienced in my life prior to, since, or because of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because they loved me enough to correct me when I was wrong. When I said one of those off-colored four-letter words, they didn't say tee-hee-hee. They said, we don't do it that way, Johnny. We say it this way. Then they stood my wrath when I rained on them. And I did rain on them. I understand today, as a result of hindsight, which is where we gain all our knowledge from, we don't ever know nothing unless we've already done it. Well, that's true. I'll never know that I was in Portland until I leave. I mean, that's deep. But that's as deep as I get. But I understand it. I understand why today, when somebody loves me enough to correct me, I understand why. I also understand why today somebody would put up with my nonsense and my unacceptable behavior. The only reason anybody would put up with my nonsense and my unacceptable behavior is, sooner or later, they'll want me to put up with their nonsense and their unacceptable behavior. That's the only reason. What if I'm not going to live in such a way? What if I'm not going to live in such a way that somebody will have to overlook my nonsense and my unacceptable behavior? That puts me in a position when I do not have to put up with your nonsense and your unacceptable behavior. And I can express my opinion on that whenever I want to. The difference, isn't it? Big difference. That's what these little men had. So when somebody pats you on the back and tee-hee-hees and says, that's all right, sweetie. You didn't drink over that. When they get ready to do it, they'll want you to do the same thing. It's happened to me in Alcoholics Anonymous in the years that I've been here, and if you stay here, it'll happen to you too. But thank God, my sponsor wasn't like that. My sponsor walked right down the middle of the road. He was the most disciplined, principled man I've ever known in my life. He never deviated from the middle of the road. He never told me what to do, when to do it. He told me that if I wanted what he did, I had to do what he did. And I liked what he did and what he had, so I did what he did, and I got what he got. Just a complete and total life of happiness and joy. The 23 years that I've lived in Alcoholics Anonymous has been the most fantastic experience of living that I know of. It's been the easiest thing I've ever done in my life. Staying sober with you in this way of life is the easiest thing I've ever done in my life. This is the easy way to live, folks. You know what I got? I got the low cost of high living. That's what I got. I know about the high cost of low living. Tell me. You hear that? I come walking out of that penitentiary a little over 21 years ago, 21 and a half years ago. I went home to my mother's house. She fell off step blind drunk. I picked her up and put her on a couch, said, "Mama, I'm going to an AA meeting." She said, "Fine, I think you should." It took my mother a long time to get to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm very proud tonight to tell you, when she's sober, she goes to meetings. She called me up this morning drunk. I know she was drunk. To tell me she was doing all right. They do that, you know. "I want you to know I'm doing all right." "Fine, Mom. See you Monday." "May not be there. Got a cold, you know." I've learned the greatest lesson in life from my mother. This is my lesson from my mother. I learned I do not have the power to get anybody sober. I don't have the power to get them drunk either. I don't even have any power to keep me sober. Where would I get any power? Where would I get it? I didn't have any coming here. Where would I get it? That book don't tell me I got any power. That book tells me I got a daily reprieve, contingent upon my maintenance of certain spiritual conditions, period. This is what I got. This day, right now, this is it. There ain't no tomorrow. I may not even get back to my room tonight. I don't know that. So this is what I got. Why should I trouble myself with problems that I cannot solve? With things I have no control over, of people, places, things. Why should I trouble myself about other people's actions, about the things that they do? Why should I do that? The only reason I would do that is because I thought I had some power to change their life. Spiritual conditions mean to me this, and that's all. I can't do anything you can't watch. It's almost like having a pet parrot and giving it to the town gossip and not worrying. Now, I'd like to tell you I live that way. And if you believe that, I want to sell you a building in 5 minutes. They only made one perfect person. And they hung him on a piece of wood because he scared everybody. And you can't love something that's perfect. It scares you. If you're imperfect, perfect scares you. It does me. I learn to love people when I see them. That's why I love you so much. Because you're like me, imperfect. That's what it used to bother me. I used to see weakness. I used to think weakness. I used to detest weakness because I was weak. And I thought weakness was weakness. I thought tears were weakness. I thought hugging somebody was weak. I thought telling somebody that you loved them was weak. See, I never told anybody prior to coming to Alcoholics Anonymous that I loved them. I didn't use the word for no reason that I use the word "I love you." I learned that here. I've had a lot of things happen to me when I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous. I got into the place that we all get to, 5, 6, 7, or 8. If you ain't there, you'll get there. And if you've been through it already, you'll understand what I mean. Something happens to me in my 5th, 6th, 7th, or 8th year. I know what it is. I got an idea in my head that because I had a house and a car and a couple of kids and a nice wife, and a good job, and a lot of credit, that I was going to belong somewhere I'd never fit, out there with them. The only way I've ever fit out there is to drink. I still don't, you know, I'm still not fitting out there. Now, that doesn't mean I'm not out there every day and I don't move and have my being. I'm very successful in what I do. Very successful. I make good money and do a lot of nice things out there. I just don't belong out there. I ain't like them. I'm different. The book says I got the delusion that I have to be like other people, got to be smashed. I'm just not like them, folks. I'm sorry. That don't make me better than them. I just not like them. See, if you ain't an alcoholic, you'll never understand that. I don't care what you are. You'll never understand that. You'll never understand what it's like to be totally bodily and mentally different from our fellows if you're not alcoholic. You'll never understand that. I don't care if people who aren't alcoholics will never understand that. That's the common bond that you and I have. the great knowledge that together, you and I, can stay sober one day at a time. By ourselves, with them, we can't. You see, to anybody else besides the alcoholic, to have a little upheaval is just to have a little upheaval. The alcoholic who has an upheaval dies because he's afflicted with a killer disease. It's the most deadly killer disease upon the face of this earth. There isn't any disease that kills more people than alcoholism does. None. That's what I got. It's necessary for me to live in such a way that I don't get upset enough to have to drink. Okay. I'm going to tell you a couple stories. These are true stories, and the reason I'm going to tell them to you is because I like the way I tell them. And they make me want to cry. Every time I tell these stories, they make me want to cry. The first one is, every year I get to go to a little place in San Jose to talk at an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. And a few years ago, maybe 8 or 9 years ago or so, we started this meeting. And what we did, they rented a big old hall, these kids up there, and they asked me to come up there and talk at this meeting. And they brought all these kids from these drug recovery houses out of there. And I remember I'm moving in and sitting down over in the corner there, and I got a coat and a tie on and a cup of coffee, and I'm sitting there, and some kid comes up. Now, he's hip. He's so hip that the balls of his feet tickles him when he walks up there. He got to, hey, baby, and I said, yeah. He says, are you Johnny Harris? And I says, yep. And he says, you don't look like him. I said, oh, what does he look like? He said, I don't know, man. He said, they've been paying your tape over there for 6 months. He says, you know, you did all them things. You went all them places and done all that stuff. And you know, man, you just got it all. And I said to him, well, if I had long hair, beard, and talked out of the corner of my mouth and wore combat boots, would that fit it? He said, yay. I said, no, you don't understand, young man. I live by a program that's spiritual in nature. When practice is a way of life, evolves you out of that garbage. He said, the hell you say. He turned and walked off. How do you know? A few months later, I'm in a place in Reno, Nevada, at an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. It's a Saturday night, and I walk in, and I sit down over there in the corner to get me a cup of coffee, and look in the front row, and there sits that kid. Only it ain't the same kid. He got his hair cut, and he's clean shaven. He got a new shirt and a pair of slacks on, and he's bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. He stands up, and he... And I run over there, and he grabs me, and he kisses me. And he said, I want to let you know that I live by the same spiritual program that you do. And I almost died. Every time I think about that, I cry. And the reason I think about that is because I think how easy it would have been for me to kill him in San Jose. I could have killed him really easy in San Jose. All I'd had to do was get down with him. You know what I mean? Talked it. Yeah, I could have got right down with him. You ever notice that? Out there? What they say out there? Hey, baby, let's go get down. How come nobody ever comes and says, let's go get up? I'm going to tell you why. Because ain't nobody that's down that wants you up. Because those who are down when you're up, you're a testimony to the lie that you're living. See? When you walk up on the sunny side of the street and they're sitting there with your feet in the gutter, you don't have to put your feet down in the gutter. You can stand up on the sidewalk on the sunny side of the street because it isn't necessary to go down into the gutter. Because they're in the gutter and you're standing on the streets, it's a testimony to the lie that you're living. Nobody who is alcoholic, who's ever been to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, can ever possibly ever again justify drinking and living the way they're living. Not to themselves. See, I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love to see things like that. People hugging and kissing. I used to think that was stupid. I used to think that was weak. You told me that's not weak, that's strong. Life is good. What's it like today? It's absolutely fantastic. That's right. I got it all, folks. That's the truth. I got it all. I've been given it all right here. You know that for a while in Alcoholics Anonymous, I tried to go somewhere. That's right. I came in here and I saw people who were doing things in AA. I thought, man, that's where I want to get to. I want to be a, I want to be a secretary or something. I want to get there. You know, when I quit trying to get anything, I got it all. For a long time around here, I kept trying to go somewhere. I thought there was some place you had to arrive. Where you had to get to, you know, as high as you get here sober? You get any higher than that, you leave. And when I quit trying to go anywhere, I've been all over the world. It's amazing. Amazing to me. Everybody knows me knows I love to play golf. I'll play golf anytime anybody asks me. And a few years ago, a company I worked for bought me a membership in a country club. I remember one Wednesday, I was out there right after I joined the club. I'm playing golf with some doctors. And I'm walking down the fairway. I got a short sleeve shirt on. And on my arms, I got things like daggers through skulls with blood dripping from them. Panthers with a little side shot. They're real conversational pieces in the coffee shop. And the little doctor looks at me and he says, "Hey, Johnny," he said, "will you ever play baseball?" I said, "Sure, I played ball every time I went to jail." He said, "You've never been in jail." And I didn't tell him any different because that's never been my deal. I used to be bad, now I'm wonderful. And I'm kind of glad because I've known this little man for a long time. I love him to pieces. And he told me a story. You see, he was a little orphan in New York in the Bronx. And he worked and he studied and he sacrificed. He did without and he got himself out of that orphanage and he worked and he studied and he sacrificed. He did without and he put himself through school and he worked and he studied and he sacrificed. He did without and he became a doctor. And he worked and he studied and he sacrificed. He bought a house. He joined the country club and he plays golf on Wednesdays and that's his deal. All his life he's worked and studied and sacrificed and did without and that's the way. I have no way of telling a little man that I spent my entire lifetime running in and out of penitentiaries and nut houses up and down the streets. I used and abused and took from people all my life. I got sober and ended up in the same place he did. And the reason I can't tell him because he won't believe it. He won't believe it because he says you can't get from there to here. That's what he says. That's what society says. You can't get from there to there. There ain't no way for me to get from a cell in solitary confinement crawling around barking at the moon where I stand right now. There ain't no way. There ain't no courses you could take. I couldn't do enough. I couldn't work hard enough. I couldn't do enough good deeds to deserve the life that's mine right this moment. No way. I have to assume that my life is a gift. A gift from God. When I came here, I asked people about that. What about sobriety? They said it's a gift from God. Now, being the type of person I was when I came here, I didn't want to owe God nothing. So I said to them, what do I do for God? And they smiled at me and said, what you do with your sobriety would be your gift to God. I've thought about that a great deal since I've been here. My sobriety is the most priceless thing that I possess. I do nothing to put it in jeopardy. I live no way in contrary to its teachings. I treasure it above all things, and I love it above all things, my sobriety. If what I do with my sobriety would be my gift back to my loving Father God, I would only pray for one thing and one thing only for as long as I live. I would only pray that my loving Father God would be as pleased with my gift to Him today as I've been with his for 23 years. Thank you.